Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby, and this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. Claire, my normal co-host, is out. She's still on vacation for the holiday. But we have I don't want to say he's a special guest, but he's a guest.
It would be wrong to begin the podcast with a lie. We try to be sincere here in everything we say.
Our producer, who we normally say something mean about at the end of the show, is going to step in and he's going to fill Claire's shoes here, which it's sort of fitting for Final Fantasy because our producer James is his name, is a huge Final Fantasy fan.
Yes, I am.
On the show, we discuss new nerd creations that are coming out or have came out, and we talk about the roots of the characters in them and the stories they tell, and we also talk about the production of those creations. And like I said, today we're talking about Final Fantasy 15.
A big deal.
Which is a big deal. It's a big deal. It's a huge game. A little background on Final Fantasy 15. Final Fantasy 15 is an open-world action role-playing game developed and published by Square Enix for the PlayStation 4 and Xbox One, and it was released on November 29th of 2016 worldwide. And, I mean, obviously it's Final Fantasy 15. It's like the 15th main title in the series, but there's all sorts of other spin-off games that go along with the Final Fantasy franchise. Now, James is going to be telling us about the tropes of Final Fantasy, the themes of Final Fantasy games. They're kind of common throughout most of them.
What it means to be a Final Fantasy game, what you can expect going into it, what the world of Final Fantasy is, and what its themes tend to be.
Yeah, and I'll be talking about how the game was made and a little bit about Square, the first version of Square Enix. It's been through a couple different names, and the making of this game. And we're both huge Final Fantasy fans. This is actually going to be a lot of fun. So James, why don't you take it away? Tell me about Final Fantasy themes.
I want to start off describing what I would call a generic Final Fantasy encounter that could happen in any Final Fantasy title that you were about to play, and you wouldn't be surprised. Let's say that you start out, and you're a warrior, and next to you is a monk who fights with their fists, and next to them is a black mage who uses destructive magic, fire bolts and lightning, and then also with them is a white mage who uses healing spells for when you get hurt by enemies. And the four of you set off, and you're going to rescue a princess that's in a castle, and she's being held captive by an evil wizard slash emperor.
Emperor, it's often an emperor. Yeah.
It's often an emperor. And usually, whatever evil plan that he has is going very, very well, at least at the beginning of the game.
Yeah, it's the gravy train for him.
It is. It's smooth sailing for most evil wizards in Final Fantasy, at least at the beginning. You're off to get him. He's going to be in a European-style castle. You're going to have European-style magic and swords and garments, and that's the kind of towns you're going to pass through.
Yeah, a lot of knights and stuff, squires.
Exactly, the typical high fantasy standard fare. And maybe guarding the princess, he's got a dragon, and you're going to fight that dragon. But here's where things get a little different with Final Fantasy. Some of your characters are going to have swords. Some of them are going to have guns.
Yeah.
And they're going to be using magic and guns at the same time to defeat like a high fantasy monster like a dragon. So let's say they defeat the dragon, they get the princess, they're headed back out, leaving the castle, where all of a sudden they may be attacked by a giant robot.
Yeah.
The kind that you see in anime.
And the giant robot probably works for the emperor.
Oh, he most certainly does. But this is the thing about Final Fantasy. Fantasy is in the title, but it is also science fiction. Science fiction is a major part of it. And one of the beauties of this world, and the first game I ever played was Final Fantasy VII, and it blew my mind looking at it as a kid, because they had a world where you could have giant robots and people in clean, modern, Western-style suits with shotguns, but also people wearing more high fantasy-style armor with giant swords, and they could all coexist together.
Well, they weren't coexisting, though.
Well, they were battling it out.
It didn't seem weird.
It wasn't weird. In fact, it was beautiful. There's a certain look to it that you might call steampunk, but that gets too high science fiction to me for how advanced the technology gets to really call steampunk while also retaining elements of high fantasy. And it's all brought together by really high quality character design, which for a long time was done by Yoshitaka Amano, who could make it look like a giant robot and a dragon and a beautiful woman with a sword that's the size of her were meant to exist together.
Yeah.
And you should really look up his illustrations with watercolors in his sketchwork. It's beautiful. Anyway, back to my little pretend scenario where you defeat this giant robot and you decide, hey, I don't want to have any more random encounters. I don't want to walk around and all of a sudden have a giant robot leap out at me. I want to go so quick, they can't keep up. And I want to hear delightful music play while I do it, which is another hallmark of the series. Fantastic music.
Yeah.
You would then call your friend the Chocobo, which is one of my favorite parts of Final Fantasy. It's one of my favorite parts of 15.
It's a pretty cool little creature, the Chocobo.
Imagine a magical bird that is yellow, like a giant canary ostrich slash Big Bird from Sesame Street.
Like, it looks like Big Bird.
Yeah, it's Big Bird with an orange beak and a smile on that beak. Yeah. Loving blue eyes.
It's like if you mixed Big Bird with like a cute lap dog.
Yeah, slash magical chicken you could ride.
Yeah.
You get on top of this thing, the Chocobo theme song plays, and you ride wherever you want. Anyway, a Chocobo is one of those distinctly Final Fantasy things. It's been in every game since Final Fantasy II.
Yeah.
You can't imagine a Final Fantasy without it. And that's just an example of one of their creatures. But for the most part, what they're doing is they're mixing in all these different mythologies from all over the world. And like I said, with mixing science and magic and with beautiful character design, making it like it should be together.
Yeah.
They do that with mythologies from all over the world. One of the big places you see that is the magical monsters, creatures, beings, gods that you can summon to help you fight. And they have all kinds of different names across the series. But
they're normally called summons. Like, if you play the game, you call them summons. But they're not in the games. They're not always called summons.
Yes, but they're not always called summons in the game, but you do summon them. And we would talk about the summons in each game, even if they had different names.
You know, Final Fantasy VIII, they were guardian forces. But I never called them that. I called them summons.
Right. You know? So for the influence of those summons from across the world, I just want to pick out a few just so you can see how diverse it is. One of the people that you could summon to help you would be Shiva, who's one of the main three gods in Hinduism, and she has to do with both destruction and creation. And in Final Fantasy, they go with the goddess tradition of Shiva so that she can be a beautiful woman showing up to help you.
Yeah, because all the depictions of Shiva I've seen in Hinduism, it's a dude.
I looked it up. There is a goddess tradition. I don't think she is as scantily clad as she is in these games. That's something we can talk about later on.
She wears like an ice bikini in every Final Fantasy. Yes. She's always ice. At least
always ice, which is very interesting. I mean, I think she has some curative magic in some of the games too, but for the most part, she's associated with ice. Opposite of that, you have Ifrit, who, if you imagine the Balrog from the Fellowship of the Ring, the way they depicted the Balrog in the movie, a fire demon with horns, that's Ifrit. And that is from an Arabic myth that has to do with a group of genie that...
they're in the realm of the jinn, There's genies, there's jinn, and there's ifrits.
Yes, and they have fire powers.
Yeah.
Or they're associated with fire. In the same game, though, you could summon Odin, the All-Father, from Norse mythology.
Yes.
And in the same game, in Final Fantasy VII, this was the greatest summon you could do.
Yeah.
The Knights of the Round Table, where King Arthur and everybody who had ever warmed a seat at that table showed up and laid the smack down in one of the longest animations you could have in the game.
Even Mordred, you think, was laying a smack down in that?
He might have been in there. A lot of people got in on that.
And Odin is always a boss in the games.
Odin's always
like, not like a boss that you fight him, but just incredible.
Incredible. Yeah. As he should be. That's another thing. And in Final Fantasy 15, they live up to this tradition. When you get to summons in this game, it is supposed to take your breath away. You were supposed to feel like this little system attached to your TV is helping you to see something godlike happen.
Yeah.
And the bar of that changes over the years, but 15, for modern times?
It does good. Yeah, I think it does well with that.
Yeah, it really does. It's spectacular. One of the things that I want to make sure that we convey here is the big themes of Final Fantasy that you're going to see in all the games, or at least most of them.
Because everyone I've played have like these themes, I think.
Yeah, no, and Kyle, as somebody who's played several games in the series as I have, you recognize them.
Yeah.
You know that we're going to deal with nature versus science. We're going to deal with man over-harvesting the resources of the planet, and sometimes the planet fighting back, and other times your characters being the only ones who can help fight back and restore balance to the world.
Yeah, the relationship between humanity and science and humanity and nature is such a huge part of every Final Fantasy I've ever played.
Yeah, But there's this thing where in Final Fantasy, magic and science live side by side, and science is often abusing the natural magical resources and life source of the planet for the people who control that science's own nefarious ends.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You're coming up against that as your rebel band over and over and again.
Yeah.
Sometimes because you're destined to and you are called upon to do it by mythical forces, and other times because you're part of the downtrodden, disenfranchised, yeah. slum-living orphans.
You're almost always in a rebellion.
Yes, yes. That yeah, you're the little guy, and you're trying to make sure that balance is restored. And Final Fantasies, like 15, like many before them, a lot of times the way that the Earth relates to you personally with its magical forces through crystals or yeah. orbs. And Final Fantasy 15 is no different in that. Your character, Noctis, has been anointed by the crystal to be king. Anyway, I want to talk about one game in particular. Actually, two. Final Fantasy 6 and Final Fantasy 7, which are two of my favorites from the series. Final Fantasy 7 being the first I ever played, where you see those themes of the balance of nature and the life force of the planet versus technology and man's aims for it really play out. In Final Fantasy VI, the magical creatures that I was talking about earlier that you summon are being drained of their life forces in cells, in labs, to fuel the war machine of the Emperor. And his court wizard eventually remakes the world in his own image after betraying the Emperor. And that world is called the World of Ruin, and it's toxic. There's a point where you're trying to nurse your grandfather back to health, and, well, if you're me, you can't separate the poison fish from the good fish, and Grandpa dies. It didn't have to happen.
You can do it in a way that he lives, apparently.
But. Yeah, but I've heard that that's not as good a story as when Grandpa dies, and you say, you were never supposed to leave me alone, and you weep, and...
Really, James just wanted the inheritance, so he made sure that the grandfather died.
You love this fish, Grandpa. Anyway, and what your heroes have to do is restore the world back to the world of balance. So that's a really extreme example of those themes. Final Fantasy VII, I think we referred to it earlier, where you have people living in slums, working in factories, harvesting the magic at the Earth's core for this evil company/government, Shinra.
And that's the thing, in Final Fantasy VII, it's not an emperor, it's a company. And even one of the villains in that company, Heidegger, is named after a German philosopher, Heidegger, who... His whole philosophy, or one of the aspects of his ideas, were that mankind were supposed to go out and tame nature.
Yes. The taming of nature is really interesting because for both 7 and 15 as examples, in 7, like we said, they are basically raping the planet to get its magical energy, which they use kind of like we would use oil.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But although that's wrong, when the Earth decides to respond and fight back, it fights back with these weapons, these
like
monsters
these
that come out of the
monsters,
Earth.
Monsters, mass destruction.
Yes. And
collateral damage.
Yes, collateral damage. Even if Shinra, that evil corporation, has it coming, your fighters still have to stop them. And in Final Fantasy 15, you have this beautiful crown city where everything is high-tech, science fiction, wonderful. And if you step outside the city, you start to see why maybe nature needs some taming. Yeah. You know, just like you got to clear all the wolves away from the outskirts of Paris in Europe back in the day. You know,
you got to clear the monsters away from the gas stations and diners that seem to litter the world of Final Fantasy
XV. Exactly, but that is also real life and how we've developed in nature. We're a part of it, and it's something that we must steward, but it is also dangerous to us. And Final Fantasy deals with that. I want to put a little bookmark on something that I want to come back to. One other thing in Final Fantasy is that we tend to have all kinds of super powerful women.
Yeah.
That are integral to the plot, that are sometimes the lead characters.
That are playable characters.
Playable characters.
Always.
And some of the most powerful, some of the most important and compelling. And in Final Fantasy 13, it was a woman for 3 games in a row. Yeah. Lightning was the main character. Yeah. In Final Fantasy 6, there's 3 people who could claim to be the main character. 2 of them are women. And in this game, Final Fantasy 15, you're playing all guys all the time, and you have no choice. And the one woman that you're seeing on the regular, not too happy about how she's portrayed. And we'll talk about that in the opinion section, but one of the things I want to say is that Final Fantasy has been doing that for a long time, and I think it's easier to see when they have great 3D modern graphics, how they're dressing these women and these characters.
Yeah.
If you go back to Final Fantasy IV, the character Rydia, who's a summoner, goes and lives with the summons for a while, becomes more powerful. When she comes back, she wears what game trailers in their retrospective called a more mature costume. I would call it a one-piece swimsuit and a cape. And that might not strike you as wild as it is when...
Isn't that what Miss Marvel wears?
It is. But when you start to see better and better graphics, you start to go, oh, wait a minute, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
Or one more example stands out because it's on the Nintendo and they're trying to do it with those little chintzy 8-bit graphics, but pushing it as far as it can be pushed for the time.
Yeah.
In Final Fantasy III, there is an ancient evil force, a cloud of darkness, which has really been behind the whole thing, classic Final Fantasy. When that cloud takes a form to fight you at the end, it turns itself into half a naked woman. Because if you were an ancient cloud of darkness and could fight any way you wanted to, wouldn't you be a topless woman leaning over with her chest out of the swirling cloud of darkness?
That's what I would do.
If you could be anything.
If you could be anything.
So anyway, we can talk more about that in the opinion section. Kyle has been so forgiving in how long this has gone on. What a champ.
Yeah, James, you're gonna next time we record,
no, you're
and I'm going
sure.
over, I'm going to be like, remember that time? Remember that time? And yeah. Claire will do the same thing. And Claire's going to scold you when she gets back. I know she is. She's going to listen to this episode and she's going to scold you.
Isn't Claire responsible for this at the end, though? Isn't she, though?
With her decadently long Californian vacations.
How good it must be.
All right, James. Let me say something on this show, all right, for once. I have a lot to say about production. I know that this stuff you said was very cool, too. But let's get into the production of Final Fantasy. I want to talk about first Square, the company, because before it was Square Enix making Final Fantasy games, it was Square Soft making Final Fantasy games, and before it was Square Soft, it was just Square. So Square was founded in 1983. They're a Japanese company, and they were founded by Masafumi Miyamoto, and Square was a software development company and was a division of Denyusha. Denyusha was a power line construction company, and I thought that was kind of weird, and when I looked into it more, I found out that Miyamoto, who founded Square, is the son of the guy who owns Denyusha, the construction company. So what it really was is that Miyamoto saw that there was kind of like a video game boom going on in the 80s, and he didn't want to build construction lines. He was like, I want to get into video games and like try and make a company. Now, Miyamoto can't code or anything. He can't make a game. He just thought it would be a cool company.
And we're
to
talking
start.
About the Miyamoto that created The Legend of Zelda.
No. Mario. That's another thing. Unrelated. They are unrelated. Same surname, not related. Now, at the time in the early 80s, video games were normally completely developed by one developer. And if you listen to our Sid Meier episode, that's a good example. Sid Meier, who made the Civilization games, he made the Civilization 1 by himself. And Miyamoto, not of Legend of Zelda but and Mario, but of Square, thought that that was kind of a silly idea, and he was one of the first people to hire graphic designers, programmers, story writers, and musicians to all fill different roles on the same game, instead of having one super nerd try and do all of that himself. And the way he could kind of afford this was that A, his dad had a successful power line company, and B, he started trying to like court college students from local colleges to try and come work for him part-time.
Brilliant.
And what he did was he set up an internet, and it wasn't an internet cafe, but it was a computer cafe.
Speaking of which, if you'd ever like to intern for Dragon Sexy Robots and Adventures and are willing to take no money for quality experience, we've got something we could talk about.
Yeah, we could come to contact us.
We'll figure it out.
But he initially set up a computer cafe with the most up-to-date Apple II computers that you could find. And he was just kind of luring college students to be like, I got cool toys, like come play in my shop. You know, it's a little...
Yeah, you like video games,
it's a little
right?
Stranger with candy sort of thing. But one of those students who dropped out of college to work for Square because of this was a man named... Hironobu Sakaguchi.
Whoa, Sakaguchi dropped out of school?
Dropped out of school to go work for Square, and he was lured by those Apple II computers, which were shiny and new, and he couldn't afford. He was a poor college student. So even though Square was really innovative in trying to hire a bunch of different people to work on games, and they were getting young people, they were not being very successful. Most of the games they made were very similar to the games of the time, you know, like side-scrolling shooters or text-based adventures. They weren't doing anything new with anything. And actually, their most successful games, which were only kind of successful, were straight up accused later of being ripoffs of better Sega versions of those games. Like, you know, these racing games and stuff. They did a side-scrolling shooter based on Aliens by James Cameron. And one of the funny games I looked up was an erotic text-based adventure called Alpha, which came out in 1986, and Sakaguchi worked on that.
Oh, my goodness.
But those are very popular. There was a lot of those at the time.
Yeah, that's the same man that's going to make the Cloud of Darkness a naked woman.
I mean, he didn't design the characters, but maybe.
He oversaw. You just told me it's in their DNA,
yeah,
man.
That's true. All right, so Sakaguchi eventually became director of planning and development for Square. And like I said, Square was never very successful. And in 1987, Sakaguchi decided to place all his eggs in one basket, or hedge all his bets, whatever phrase. The company wasn't doing that well. Sakaguchi decided he would make one more game, and the success of this game would determine if he would stay in the gaming industry or would go back to school. And it would likely determine if Square was going to succeed, because the company was always, like, just barely above water. And Sakaguchi said, he he wasn't great at making action games. The thing he really wanted to do was tell a good story. And he jokingly named his possibly last game Final Fantasy. And that's why there's so many Final Fantasies, because it was supposed to be like his swan song before he left the industry.
It's so wonderful, the idea of being an artist and thinking this is it and pouring your heart and soul into it without a care.
Yeah.
Like, you've made peace with this could be it, so let me just make it the best it could be for me.
For the thing that I want the most.
Right.
I want to tell a story with knights and stuff. I don't want to do an erotic text-based adventure.
If it gets erotic later, that's fine.
It's fine.
We'll work it in. There'll be context and meaning to it. I'm not against eroticism. That's me being Sakaguchi.
Yeah, that's James being James. Yeah.
Anyway, no, but it's a wonderful story.
Yeah. Now, Sakaguchi based his game on Dungeons & Dragons, which was really at the height of its popularity, I think, in the mid-80s. It's getting big now, but that was when it was like, Dungeons & Dragons was such a huge thing.
When you didn't have an alternative for your dungeon-crawling fantasies.
Exactly. And the beauty of a video game kind of doing your Dungeons & Dragons for you was that you didn't have to crunch any numbers yourself. And that's the thing, if you don't know, in Dungeons & Dragons, you have your characters and you have like their stats and stuff filled out on a sheet, and you have a person walk you through an adventure, and you know they put up scenarios and you have to react in certain ways, and your stats determine.
And there are books with beautiful illustrations, but really it's evoking your imagination.
It's all
that's
the imagination.
Where the game lives.
Yeah.
But that's also true of the Nintendo games.
Yeah, that's true. And well, Final Fantasy was going to crunch a lot of those numbers for you. And Final Fantasy was way ahead of its time as far as RPGs go. They had a job system, which was very interesting for the time, where you could pick certain jobs. You could have a warrior, you could have four warriors, or you could have a warrior, a mage, and a white mage, and a black mage. There was a ton of different variety in the characters. And it's also, for its time, the characters were really interestingly designed, and so were the monsters. And the battle system was greatly improved upon, based on like what previous RPGs were. In previous RPGs, the battle system, you were fighting your battles from a first-person perspective.
Mm-hmm.
In Final Fantasy, you jumped back and you were in third-person. You kind of saw the battlefield, and it was easier to understand what was going on. And also, just the rudimentary combat animations that they had in Final Fantasy was such a big deal at
that
time.
Which we take for granted now.
Yeah.
All of that, the idea that you can see everything that's happening, that
you're
you would have those kind of colors
and
music.
Yeah. Back then, you know, you saw a little arm and like a slash and a whoosh noise, and you're like, oh my God, look at that. So Sakaguchi would go on to direct the first five Final Fantasies, and he was a producer on Final Fantasy until Final Fantasy IX. Final Fantasy IX was his last producing credit on Final Fantasy. Obviously, the series has been very successful. Now I want to switch gears and jump ahead to Final Fantasy XV and kind of the development of that, which started back in 2006, which
historic.
I found really fascinating. Yeah, it's been 10 years. It took 10 years for this game to be made. So this game didn't actually start as Final Fantasy XV. It started as Final Fantasy Versus XIII, and was being helmed by Tetsuya Nomura. Now, Tetsuya Nomura had worked for Final Fantasy for a while, and he had done the character designs on Final Fantasy V, VI, VII, VIII, and X. And he was the lead developer on a game called Kingdom Hearts. And if you're a Final Fantasy Squaresoft nerd, or even just a video game nerd in general, you know what that is and have probably played it. Kingdom Hearts is a real-time action RPG that combined the worlds of Disney and Final Fantasy, and it was hugely successful. I thought it must have been planned to be massively successful, but what I read in articles, they didn't think it was going to be that big of a deal. But it was. I don't know how you couldn't think.
How could you think that the power of Disney's licensed characters.
Yeah.
And Squaresoft's ability to make an RPG.
Now, this is in 2002, though, so it's not the Disney we know that seems to be ruling the world.
Mickey
but that's
Mouse
when they were getting ready.
Mickey Mouse has been a big deal. When was Mickey Mouse was a big deal from day
one. Yeah, that's
one.
True.
And in
that's
that game,
true.
I think the first game, you're not saving a princess. You're saving Mickey.
You're saving Mickey. You're looking for Mickey is what it is, actually. But yeah. And it's they're some of my favorite games. I think they're really cool. But that's what he helmed. And so after the massive success of that, Square was like, okay, like what game do you want to work on? And he wanted to work on a spinoff of the Final Fantasy 13 game, which was also still in development. And they were like, yeah, go for it. So he was ecstatic. He grabbed his core Kingdom Hearts team, and they got to work trying to make a new and interesting game. And he really wanted to explore themes that haven't been explored in the franchise before. He wanted it to be a little more real, like have more realism in this game. And it wasn't going to be a main Final Fantasy title. It was going to be a spinoff. So Final Fantasy 13, not Versus 13, which is what Nomura was working on, but Final Fantasy 13 was released in 2010. And despite having decent reviews and selling well, it was not a hit amongst the core Final Fantasy fans. People weren't really that into the non-explorable world. That's the thing about Final Fantasy games. You can go everywhere in the world normally. There's some exceptions. 10 is an exception, and 13 is an exception.
And people are upset about it and every time that happens.
They're upset every time it happens, yeah. Final Fantasy 13 had kind of a strange battle system, and a lot of people weren't that into the story. They didn't think it felt like a Final Fantasy game.
You're supposed to care.
Yeah. Now, this made Square nervous, and when Final Fantasy XIV came out, and Final Fantasy XIV also came out in 2010, which I didn't realize that both those games, 13 and 14, came out at the same time. 14 was a massive flop. It got terrible reviews.
At first.
They've patched it, and it's supposedly good now. Well, when 14 initially came out, though, it was terrible. People hated it, and Square got nervous, and they're like, all right, we need to change something, so Final Fantasy 15 is more, you know, enjoyed. People like it more. Meanwhile, Nomura and his team were encountering numerous development problems working on Final Fantasy Versus 13, which is what the game was that they were still working on. And even while his team was running into all these problems with trying to work out a real-time combat system similar to the one in Kingdom Hearts, but expanded upon, they had an idea of where you could go into like a third person shooter mode in it. They were trying to mess with, even while all that was happening, they were struggling with that on their first game. Nomura was trying to expand everything. He's like, it's not just going to be one game. It's going to be three games and the story is going to be, and he just kept making it bigger and bigger. And the team's still struggling to put out the first one. And Square is getting a little nervous. In 2012, Square decided that Versus 13 would become Final Fantasy 15. Because they thought the project was still malleable enough that they could change the storyline so that it's not in the Final Fantasy 13 world. It could be its own thing. And they got a little nervous about Nomura, so they added a co-director for the game. And Nomura seemed to be cracking under the pressure. He even apparently went into a board meeting about Final Fantasy 15 and was pushing the idea of making Final Fantasy 15 a musical. And it was right after he had seen Les Mis, which had released in Japan.
I
could just see this guy just under, so under pressure, but just like,
you know what we're going to do? It's going to be incredible. It's going to be a musical Final Fantasy 15. I don't know that he was wrong. And we talk about, has this game advanced Final Fantasy? Is it the standard bearer for JRPGs and RPGs that the past games have been? If he had done that, it'd have worked.
Yeah, that's true. Final Fantasy pushes the envelope once again with Final Fantasy 15, the musical.
One of the best moments in all of Final Fantasy is performing in an opera in Final Fantasy VI.
That's true. They do a lot of plays within a play in Final Fantasy games. So Square, obviously, were like, and like I mentioned before, they brought in a co-developer, and that person was Hajime Tabata, to hopefully grant some stability to the project. And Tabata would eventually become the sole lead director. They took Nomura off. And Nomura, he wasn't fired. While he was the lead developer on Final Fantasy 15, he was also the lead developer on Kingdom Hearts 3, which people are waiting for, and the Final Fantasy 7 remake, which is another big thing coming in the Square Enix.
It's like they gave
company.
Him every project people have been waiting 20 years for.
So it's no wonder he was kind of cracking and having a hard time. Like, it just seemed like he had a lot on his plate. When Tabata came in, he completely overhauled the hierarchy of the development team, and he eliminated the seniority kind of preference, which pissed off a lot of the developers. But his thought was that he wanted new ideas from a younger generation on the development team, and a lot of times, like, they do go with, like, seniority, like the seniority hierarchy, where if someone's been there longer, their idea is going to take precedence over someone new.
Which is ironic, because the whole thing got kicked off by a guy who dropped out of college to do this game.
This is true. This is true. But I think that's just the way companies are structured.
No, it's true. That's what startups are like. Yeah. And then that guy stays.
And so he was trying to do that, to try and get like a little bit of a new flavor and to push the envelope, because that's what Final Fantasy XV was really hoping to be, was this big envelope pusher, standard bearer for RPGs at this time. Now, Tabata tried to stay true to Nomura's original idea and flavor, but in the end, a lot was obviously changed. The road trip camping aspect of Final Fantasy XV, which is a humongous part of this game.
It's how you live it.
It's how you live it. Yeah, it's how you experience it. Is your buddies on a road trip is mostly credited to Tabata, whereas the realism was something that Nomura was really pushing for in Final Fantasy Versus 13, and that's something that you still see in Final Fantasy 15. Is it like the extreme? They tried to make it a believable world as much as a world filled with monsters can be.
You have to sometimes tear yourself away from your cell phone to fight the monsters.
Exactly. And Tabata, for the camping aspect, pulled a lot from his own experiences on road trips with his friends as a youth. So it's pretty cool. Just to get into a little facts and figures, 15 is the fastest selling Final Fantasy game to date, and it sold 5 million copies by the 1st of December, which was only 3 days after it was released. So it's selling well. It has an 8.2 out of 10 on IGN and an 82% Metacritic score. So it's critically received pretty well. But what did you think of it? Where does it fall in your rank?
I wish I was playing it right now.
So do I.
That's how I feel. Look, doing the research for this podcast, oh my goodness, do I love this series. It made me think I misspent my youth for every Final Fantasy I missed.
Yeah, it's like, why was I swimming on a swim team when I could have been playing Final Fantasy indoors all this time?
Talking with other humans?
Exactly.
That said they were my friends?
Yeah, they weren't, I don't think.
Well, actually, no, my friends got me into Final Fantasy.
As far as Final Fantasy 15 goes, is it... I mean, I feel like every Final Fantasy game has sort of been compared to 7 since it came out, because Final Fantasy 7 was, I don't know, I'm not going to say it's the best Final Fantasy game ever, but it was the most pivotal and it was the most...
Well, it is...
Game-changing.
It is, because it introduced the West in a big way to not only JRPGs, Japanese RPGs, but RPGs in general. I mean, it blew my mind as a kid.
What I'm trying to say is... Final Fantasy 15 doesn't do for the genre what Final Fantasy 7 does, and if that's what they were going for...
But I think a lot of the impact of 7 was we'd never seen that much money spent on a video game before, and we'd never seen these amazing, epic RPGs with this beautiful music rendered in 3D. Yeah. And not only that, I said the music. Final Fantasy games, so much of it was Nobuo
Uematsu. Yeah.
Uematsu.
He's really good.
He's the John Williams of these games.
Yeah.
In a way that John Williams never got to be, because the Star Wars movies couldn't maintain this quality level over so long. Yeah. But the emotional core of these, and he kept it up and got better and better.
Yeah.
And when it hit Final Fantasy VII, we had CDs instead of cartridges, so you could really hear the music.
Yeah. As you can see, James is very passionate.
Yes. No, I'm just saying, it's hard for a game to do that. That said, for being a world that I want to be in, that I want to spend time in, that is beautiful, that at times can still inspire awe, even if this isn't my first time seeing a three-dimensional game, Final Fantasy XV still does that.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time you saw summons in Final Fantasy VII?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, that was the first Final Fantasy I ever played, too. And it totally hooked me on the series and on RPGs in general. And I always loved fantasy books and reading anyway. And the fact that you could play a fun story, that's what I...
And care about people. I mean, Final Fantasy 15, still, when you do summons, when you have those moments with the music, and it is like the
epic
hand of God coming in.
Yeah.
I still haven't seen something like that.
Yeah. No, that's true. I think to compare Final Fantasy 15 to other Final Fantasies, all the ones I've played, and I haven't played them all, but the characters were a lot more important to me. Mm. And I think that's one of the parts of Final Fantasy 15, at least to me, isn't as fun. First of all, it's a dude fest. There are no women.
We gotta get
I think that's
that
a big problem.
Too. Yeah. It's a dude fest. It's your bros. And a lot of Final Fantasies, even if there were a bunch of guys, you could trade out some of the guys. It's just these guys.
Yeah.
Your three best friends who also work for you.
Yeah, who are also like, you're the king.
They
so
love
they're
you,
also
though.
Like your servants/bodyguards. But to me, they are cool characters. I don't think they're as coolly designed as some of the others. And I just don't yet... I'm 30 hours into this game, which is a good chunk. And I just don't care about them as much as I cared about some of the other characters from previous games.
I'm having the experience of playing Final Fantasy VI for the first time while playing this latest entry in the series. And I was joking with Kyle when we were, you know, discussing the podcast and how we feel about the characters, that if there was a burning building and I had to pull out as many characters as I could from Final Fantasy VI and Final Fantasy XV, all the six is coming out.
Yeah.
And there's like 12 playable characters, every last one of them. Get out of here. I love all of you. I care about you deeply. And I cared more about you faster than I did 30 hours into this.
Yeah.
And part of it is that so much of this game is a road trip, going to diners, camping,
fishing. There's cool aspects to it. Like, I love those aspects.
Yes, and it's meant to build up a living relationship with them versus dramatic narrative.
Yeah. Where they do hit really good or really well in this game is the world. The world is so engrossing and so fun. And I find myself lost in side missions more than the actual plot missions of the story. I just go and I, like, on monster hunts and stuff, and I'm having a really great time, and I do really like playing this game, and I wish I was playing it now. But it's not. In 7, I remember, I was like, oh, I gotta see what happens next. Or in 9, it was the same way. I remember in Final Fantasy 9, which is my favorite of all the games that Final Fantasy games I've played, when you're finally able to leave the continent you start on, your first continent, and see the rest of the world, I had such, like, this anticipation and fire for adventure, and I remember almost vibrating with excitement in it. And in 15, it's a really cool, big open world, and the world is very, what's the word?
Expansive.
Expansive, and you really dive into it. But I have yet to feel that, like, you know, of excitement about going to a area in that.
At the same time, it is beautiful. I think what the difference is that you do not have the sense of urgency because of something you desperately have to do.
Yeah.
Which is weird for a game that starts with your dad being murdered and your character flipping out, which is where I first really connected with him and his reaction to that. Somehow, with all these side quests that you can get distracted with and enjoy, it doesn't feel weird to not be going on to the next thing.
Yeah.
The next thing doesn't feel as important as it has in past games, which is why in the amount of time me and Kyle have played it, other people have beaten the game.
Yeah.
Which on the one hand means that the game is so enjoyable that we're getting sidetracked with all the fun things there's to do, but on the other hand means there isn't the drive. We haven't felt the drive that in past Final Fantasies we've felt to save the world.
Yeah. And I think you and I both have the same problem also in this game, with the way that, like, one of the main reoccurring female characters is portrayed.
Yeah, so Cindy, who works at the Hammersmith mechanic
Hammerhead.
Shop. Hammerhead. She's the daughter of Cid, who is a recurring character that is almost in every single Final Fantasy.
Yeah, since 2, I think, once again.
Yeah, and he's sometimes he's a pirate.
Yeah.
Sometimes he's a scientist. A lot of times he's a scientist.
Yeah, he's almost always a builder of some kind.
He's always a builder.
Engineer sort of thing.
And in almost all the games, the airships and all that, that's him.
You get this because of him.
Anyway, he has a daughter, as he does in some other games, a granddaughter, and she's also a mechanic, and she does things like fill your gas. But that is not innocuous. If your girlfriend is over, maybe don't go and get your gas filled from Cindy, because she's wearing Daisy Dukes with the thong showing.
Yeah.
She's wearing a jacket that doesn't go all the way down past her breasts, and she's wearing a swimsuit top.
Yeah.
And my gun, I just... But it's a lot. And then they do this thing where Noctis, whenever he's filling up the car, the main character, you know, he just does it, and he's like, oh, the gas is filled. He doesn't wipe the windshield off, but if you go to Hammerhead...
And Cindy fills up your gas station.
She's going to lean over and with that cleavage shown, wipe off that windshield just to make sure you're actually taken care of. And it's a bit much.
To me, Final Fantasy games have always had, like, really great female characters, really powerful female characters. In Final Fantasy VII, which is the first one I played, first one James played, they're not dressed like a... I don't want to say prostitutes, but...
No, and some of them are sexualized, but at the same time, they're very powerful. Tifa's beating up people with brass knuckles. She's not showing cleavage, but the way the
She's got huge tracts of land.
Yes, and the graphics are dedicated to letting you know, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, she's punching people straight in the face.
And you care about her. She's a great character. You love her. You know, she's important to the plot and to your party.
Yes. One of the things that I think... One of the reasons you can get away with it in some of the other games, because they've been doing this since the early games, as I mentioned before, but in the early games, you had multiple playable female characters, And then if one of them is dressed a certain way, that could be her. She likes to dress that way. We're not pretending all women are like this.
Yeah.
We have options and we care about them all. It becomes a character thing versus just how women are. But in this game, I've met there's three women in it, and you don't see two of the three 30 hours in too much.
Yeah.
So the one you're mostly seeing is that. And that makes it stand out.
Yeah. And I don't know. It does bother me. And I wish my favorite characters in Final Fantasy games traditionally are the women. Like in Final Fantasy VII, it was Yuffie. And Final Fantasy VIII, I really liked Selphie. And I like Quisitas a lot. And in Final Fantasy IX, I love Dagger. I love Freya. She might be one of my favorite characters of all time in any game. So there were just a lot of options.
Yeah. There's one more thing I'd like to say about the story of Final Fantasy XV, and that's that before this game came out, they had an anime miniseries, and they had a feature-length animated film, a CG animation.
Yeah.
And a lot of the story is in that feature-length film. And they expected you to see it. Yeah. And I think for a video game, that's unreasonable.
Yeah, it's BS.
Yeah. I shouldn't have to go pay $15 to see your movie and then pay $60 for the game
to play your game
to get the entire story.
Yeah, I think that's lame also. But it is a fun game. And, you know, Final Fantasy XV, get it, play it. Maybe don't play it in front of your girlfriend.
Don't get your gas refilled at Hammerhead.
Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby, and I had the great, he's not really terrible, James Foey with me filling in. So thank you, James, for doing that for us.
You are very, very welcome.
And this is Dragon Sexy Robots and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com, and we would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. You can find the show on Twitter at DSRA Podcast. I can be found on Twitter at Klex303. That's KLEX303.
And I can be found at James Foey Jr., FOUHEYJR.
And you can learn more about our topic, Final Fantasy XV, on our Facebook page, where we will be posting our show notes. Our producer for this episode is not the abominable James Foey, but is the always wonderful Laura Princiata. Thank you, Laura, for producing for us. And Laura is definitely the white mage of this podcast right now, keeping James and I from killing each other. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland, who is the tastefully dressed, powerful female character in all of our lives. Our theme was composed by... And our theme was composed by Pete Rowan, who is most assuredly the sexy gas station attendant that we all know and love. So once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.